What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to AmericaTrendsPodcast.com, where the future has arrived, as we like to say, John.
It's just in time.
Oh, my goodness. I think it's a little late to the dance, because I don't know. But we're still about the business of looking at all kinds of things that are going on that are not all focused on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. There's a whole world of ideas and activities. And, we've talked about everything from the mob to our public lands. I mean, we're not afraid to tackle anything on this program. And we are really excited because there is a movement afoot, John.
A movement? What kind of movement?
With a foot.
With a foot?
Yeah. Uh-oh. Or 2 feet. It's called Convention of States. Have you ever heard of this?
Never.
Okay. Well, this is all the states getting together, but they have to decide which state to get together in.
To me, this sounds very difficult.
Well, you think, like, Ohio would not travel to Texas to talk about
things. Look at the trouble the founding fathers had getting the Constitution. All the states, and they had less states then.
Right, they had fewer states, and they actually had big ideas to grapple with.
Right?
And now, of course, the whole idea of a convention of states is in order to adjust the Constitution so that certain things that aren't working terribly well, that have gotten a little bit out of phase, can be put back into phase.
It sounds like a good idea, but it sounds like an impossible task.
You think so?
Yeah, well, getting all 50 states to agree on this is...
Well, let's be honest. The founders did make it difficult for us to amend the Constitution,
right.
But that was by design, because they didn't think this should be something that we toy with and tinker with every day.
Absolutely.
But they did give us mechanisms to do it.
Yep,
they did. And, of course, they're harder than a Rubik's Cube. But this Convention of States is called a Project of Citizens for Self-Governance. And this is not just a, kind of happenstance. This is a real activity that is being undertaken with purpose. I mean, it really is. And, you know, you're going to hear from Mark Meckler, who is a co-founder of this organization. And what I like about him is he will admit that he's a conservative. And he's looking to do this with conservative principles in mind in terms of the content of this convention. But he's trying to get everybody to support this so that we can kind of wrap ourselves around some of these issues that have been long festering. And he makes no bones about who started this. But what he's trying to accomplish today, he thinks, involves many more Americans than might be suggested by way of who's on the letterhead. So we're going to listen to him about it. It's really interesting. And look, any citizen that gets this deeply immersed in a process this arcane, you got to really hand it to him.
You got to give it a try.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're all going to learn more right now in American Trends Podcast about the Convention of States. Take a listen.
Mark Meckler, a co-founder of Convention of States, a project of citizens for self-governance. Now, Mark, I'm on your mailing list. I'm on a lot of mailing lists, and I get a lot of information, but I think there are a lot of Americans probably unaware of what it is that you're attempting to do. So why don't you, in the simplest terms, explain what you're attempting through this Convention of States?
Sure. You know, I think this is the most important project in America, not just because it's the one I'm involved in, but it's because it's the one that the founders intended us to do if we ever got to the place where we felt like the federal government was unresponsive. I mean, 94% of Americans today say the federal government is out of control. They're not responsive, frankly, to people of either party. Everybody's frustrated. And so the founders gave us the second clause of Article 5 in the Constitution. That gives us the power as citizens, literally, amazingly, to bypass Congress, bypass the federal government altogether, bypass the president, bypass the courts, and to restrain the scope, power, and jurisdiction of the federal government. The founders told us this moment would come. They gave us Article 5 for this moment, and what we're trying to do is call a convention under Article 5 to do just that.
Now, when we look at the Constitution, and we just had Floyd Abrams on one of our podcasts talking about the First Amendment, and what's amazing about the document is that it attempts in many ways to blunt overactivity, hyperventilation on the part of the federal government. So what's gone wrong when our Constitution really tries very hard to limit the power of the federal government and kind of upend all of that with the power of the individual and liberty? So what's gone wrong?
Well, first of all, I think you point out something really important, that our Constitution is intended to be a document which is intended to be used actually as a weapon against federal government power. That's what it was designed for.
Right. So what's gone wrong?
Yeah, well, here's what's gone wrong. Primarily, I would argue, the courts have gone wrong. The founders called the Supreme Court especially the weakest branch of all government, had no power of the purse, had no weapons, right, no sword, as they called it. And so they expected that that branch would really not be subservient, but would be lesser in power to the other branches. Today, the judicial branch is the most powerful branch in the federal government. It determines all kinds of things for all of us, including, amazingly, how much power the federal government actually has. It has dramatically expanded the interpretation of federal government power under the Constitution. And frankly, there's literally only one way the founders gave us to fix that, and that is through an Article 5 convention.
Now, when people think about amending the Constitution, they get very leery because they say, well, we could meddle with this thing and we honor it and treasure it. And it's also a really difficult process that the founders put in place.
Yeah, those two things are both important. I mean, we shouldn't meddle with the Constitution lightly. It's supposed to be difficult. This is one of the reasons the founders made it difficult, because we shouldn't do it lightly. You know, so we've never called a convention in the entire history of the country. Getting two-thirds of states to agree on anything is incredibly high bar, very difficult. That's intentional. I think it's a good thing, because it means if you actually can get two-thirds of the states to agree on the subject matter for a convention, you've got widespread agreement about what the problem is in the country. Then it takes 38 states to ratify, which is three-quarters. Even a higher bar means you have widespread agreement on what the solution is. So I agree we shouldn't meddle with it lightly, and we're not. And I think the founders put the appropriate protections right there into the document.
Okay, explain this process to us. In other words, what is the call to this convention, and how specific or broad are the concerns that you'd like to place at the feet of these conventioneers?
Sure. Well, the actual resolution being considered all over the country now. It's been introduced, by the way, in 48 states. It's been passed in 12. It'll be pending in 20-plus states in the coming session next year. And the resolution has three what are called subject matter areas. These are areas of concern which may be discussed for the suggestion of amendments. The first is anything that would impose fiscal restraints on the federal government. The most common that people think of under that category is a balanced budget amendment, but it also would include things like imposing generally accepted accounting principles on the federal government.
Oh, my goodness. We've talked about that in Connecticut, but that's never going to happen here.
Well, you know, it's a big deal, because if you impose a balanced budget amendment and they don't have to use real accounting principles, then it's really not a balanced budget amendment. Another thing you could do is tie spending to GDP, tie it to population growth and inflation. These are common sense measures that are needed to restrain government spending. So that's the first area, anything that would impose fiscal restraints. The second area is anything that would impose scope and jurisdictional restraints. And this gets to the heart of the problem. Even if you impose a balanced budget amendment, if you don't impose the structural restraints on the government itself, what government can and can't do, then you're never going to fix the problems that face the nation. The problem is we've grown structurally out of control. So this would allow you to do things like say the federal government should not be involved in education in any of the states, which, by the way, was Thomas Jefferson's position. He was a great advocate of public education. When asked why the University of Virginia couldn't get federal funding, he said you would need a constitutional amendment to do that. We haven't had that amendment, but obviously we fund public education to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars to no good effect. So we need to restrict the federal government's ability to do certain things. And then the final one is the imposition of term limits. Now, most people think of term limits for members of Congress. We, the citizens, by the way, by initiative or proposition, passed that in 23 states before the Supreme Court decided we weren't allowed to limit our own congressional delegations. And so now we can do that by Article 5. But I think even more important, Larry, for me, is limiting the terms of federal justices, federal judges, including the Supreme Court. The founders never intended for jurors to sit on the court for 30 years, 20 years. The average age of appointment at the time of the founding was 47. Average life expectancy was 54. Gives us an idea they expected folks to serve on the court 5, 6, maybe 7 years. And we need to go back to a system like that and to restore some balance to our system of jurisprudence.
Well, look at the U.S. Senate. I mean, my goodness, that becomes a keepsake for many. And I say to John in one of our introductions, that's a journey to the gurney because these guys stay forever. And I mean, the ages are remarkable. So you've gotten 12 states to basically agree that that would be the content of what this convention would deal with.
Correct.
Okay. Now, for those states, let's say those states went from 12 to, what's the number, two-thirds of the states?
34 states.
Okay. Say we got to 34. Then what happens at that point?
Sure. Structurally, this is where Congress has its only role in the process. It's an administrative or ministerial, secretarial role. Their job is to name the time and place of convention. We fully expect they will name the place to be Washington, D.C., in the heart of the swamp, right? All the state leaders we've talked about said they would convene there for exactly 1 hour and then move the convention somewhere in the heartland. I expect it would be somewhere, maybe Denver, Dallas, Oklahoma City, somewhere in the middle of the country.
Well, Denver, you can kind of open up your thinking a little these days.
There you go. Well, you know, hey, that's actually a place where I think we could address federal overreach should the federal government be telling states whether or not marijuana should be legal. I mean, I think that's an open question in the country right now. We've got a severe national conflict on that issue that could be resolved by a convention such as this. So those are the kinds of places. So that's Congress's only role, name, time, and place. And then after that, what happens is each state will choose its delegation made up of commissioners. They could choose one. They could choose 100. It's up to the states. Each state gets one vote in convention. I imagine that states will send fairly large delegations. They'll want expertise in all the subject matter areas. But whatever they send, however many they send, those people will be required to come to a single vote on any given issue in the convention. Now, in the convention itself, it takes a majority of states to pass anything out as a suggested amendment to the state. So it takes 26 states to pass it out. And then it goes out to the states for ratification, and it takes three-quarters of the states.
Okay, so we go from 34 to 26 and then back up again to three-quarters of the states. So this is a process. I mean, in the best of worlds, in your mind, how long would something like this ultimately take?
My expectation is that we are in convention within 36 months from right now. And I don't think that's aggressive. I think that's just realistic based on our current trends. So I expect we're in convention in about 36 months. I expect convention takes anywhere from 90 to 120 days. And then the average time for ratification of an amendment, remember the ratification process is the same whether the amendment is proposed by Congress or convention. We have an average of, in our 27 amendments, of about 18 months for ratification. So I expect that you see within about 5 years maximum that we have some new amendments to the Constitution.
Has this been done before?
It hasn't, and I think that's one of the things that makes it so incredible and exciting. People say, you know, because it's never been done before, you can't do it. Well, my argument to the contrary on that is America is a nation of doing the impossible. That's all we've ever done since the founding of this country. You know, we've lasted longer than any republic. We put people on the moon. We fought World War II as the underdog. The things that we've done, just fighting against the British to found the country, incredible overcoming of odds. So we were founded to do the impossible. We're going to get it done. No, it's never been done before, and the folks who are participating right now are participating in a historic endeavor.
Now, in your materials, what does this mean? This is not a partisan issue. Washington, D.C. will never voluntarily relinquish meaningful power. And yet, some of the materials that I've gotten lately from you involve people like Jim DeMint, Tom Coburn, both of whom were Republican representatives in the Senate and the House. And then I just got something that said, let's, you know, do something about the swamp, which sounded like kind of Trump rhetoric from the campaign. So it does have that feel that it's more on the side of the conservative movement. Yet many of us, like myself, I'm a moderate. And I think, by the way, some of your numbers, about $100 trillion that we owe, are a little low. We have Lawrence Kotlikoff on one of our podcasts saying it's $200 trillion. So we're way out of whack, no matter how you look at it. You can, I guess, stop counting and start praying. But the question is, are you really taking on a bit of a tinge of a conservative movement?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is absolutely. And it's not that it is ideologically conservative, but the movement started on the right, and you can't hide that. You know, I definitely come from the right. I describe myself as a conservatarian. I'm a mix between a libertarian and a conservative. I'm a conservative at home in my own life, but generally societally, I'm very libertarian. So it starts with me. It started with Michael Ferris, who's very much of a conservative. Obviously, Tom Coburn's a conservative, Jim DeMint. So that's where the movement comes from, and I think there's a reason for that. It's not about partisanship. It's until very recently, Larry, the only people really talking about the Constitution were people on the right. I'm in California. That's where I've been born and raised my whole life. I have a lot of friends on the left. Honestly, never heard one of them talk about the Constitution, pro or con, just not something that they think about. So the idea of using constitutional tools generally doesn't come from the left. If you look at our endorsers, though, it's interesting because what you see is, talking about moderates on the right first, you see, for example, Jeb Bush is a major endorser, Marco Rubio is a major endorser. There's all kinds of moderates on the right that have come to play here. And then just let's talk about it ideologically, because I think that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm in California. It's really relevant right now. About 31% of the population says we ought to secede from the union. And that 31% is not conservative. That's the left side. They're talking about federalism. They're talking about the appropriate separation of powers between the federal government and the states. A lot of my friends on the left are finding a newfound love or a first-found love for federalism these days. I want California to be as liberal as it wants to be. Look, it's not my ideology, but that's the majority of people in California. That should be the character of the state. I want New York to be that way or Illinois. But in Texas, they ought to be as conservative as they want to be. And so I would fight and die for the right of all the states to reflect their political character, and Washington, D.C. is preventing that today.
When we look at it, certain people will look at the term states' rights, and they will go back to nullification efforts. Mm-hmm. They'll go back to a turning back civil rights legislation. Mm-hmm. How do you counter that when people think of states versus the federal government? They say, well, the federal government has helped people to earn rights that legitimately are theirs but have been reluctantly provided by many states. What would you say to that?
You know, it's interesting. First of all, just generally speaking, language matters in how we talk about things, and I never talk about states' rights because I know that's a loaded term and it brings up a lot of bad stuff in our history. What I talk about is local control. That's what matters to me. People in their local circumstances know their situations better than people in Washington, D.C., and they should have the control. And whether I'm speaking in Berkeley, California, where I do speak, or in Lubbock, Texas, where I do speak, people believe that they should be in charge of their whole, their own lives. This is about who decides, not what is decided. So I think that's the fundamental thing is how do we define the fight? It's not about states' rights. But I also think there's an important thing we need to remember about our history. People talk about, for example, the federal government's role in ending segregation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, literally 75 years before we had the Civil Rights Act, there were states that were attempting to desegregate, and the Supreme Court actually stopped them. So we had segregation in this country for 75 years because of bad Supreme Court decisions. Missouri was one of the states trying to end segregation, and the Supreme Court upheld segregation. So when people think that segregation was ended by the Supreme Court, segregation was actually extended for 75 years by the United States Supreme Court. So we should not pin our hopes and dreams on the decisions and the whims and the whimsy of nine men and women in black robes. It's just crazy. The American people know better.
Can you make certain that all of the language, in other words, the 12 states that have already signed on, did they sign the exact document one to the other?
They're virtually identical. There are small changes a couple of states made to what are called the whereas clauses, the opening or closing clauses, but the operative language is the same. And that's really important because we have over 400 applications in history for an Article 5 Convention of States. We've never gotten to one because there have never been 34 applications that could do what's called aggregating. That's a legal term that just means they're all the same, so they're the same call. So, yeah, it really matters, and we always make sure that legislators are introducing the same language in every state.
Now, what if somebody said, well, I'm really with you on the issue of debt and over-obligating ourselves. That I want to deal with. I want to grapple with that. I want a balanced budget amendment, whatever it may be. But some of these other things I'm not able to really wrap my arms around. I mean, could you see going back to the same 12 states and later the 20 others that you think are close and saying, okay, let's limit this convention even further in terms of subject matter?
I mean, I think it's theoretically possible. It certainly is theoretically possible, but I can tell you as a practical political matter, it's literally impossible. Getting over the hump in every state has never been easy in a single state. Going back and trying to redo the fight again just incredibly difficult, just the logistics of doing it. And here's the thing that makes it flexible for the states. If you have a state, for example, and we do have this, by the way, states where legislators generally do not like term limits. So you get states where legislators say, I won't vote for term limits. I don't like that. I don't even want that talked about. What we say to them is, you can instruct your delegations whatever you want. So in other words, you can send a delegation to this convention and instruct, if you're in Connecticut, you can instruct the Connecticut delegation not to vote yes on anything involving term limits, not to even engage in the debates on term limits. So the states ultimately have control of the behavior of their delegates at the convention.
So when you look at it, I mean, if somebody was worried that the scope of business at this convention was going to be dramatically changed by the force of events and the ecology of where you are and the time and what happened the last week in Congress or whatever, is that a legitimate concern for people to have, that you could really change the scope at the convention?
No, it's not at all, because the convention is bound by the applications. In other words, the only thing that's germane in a convention is what the states have applied for. And so anything that's discussed outside of those things would be outside the scope of the application. And you know, any delegate from any state could raise what's called a point of order in convention. It's the same way that legislatures operate, raise their hand and say, look, that's out of order for this convention. We can't talk about that. And that would be sustained according to any sort of normal legislative rules.
So where's the fulcrum for all of this? Do you feel there's enough upset in America today, given the stalemate and given the overreach in certain cases that the government has taken on the federal level? Is that it? Or do you think it's going to be easier, for example, to get it to a convention than necessarily it's going to be to get the three quarters of the state ultimately to vote for it? I mean, where do you think this really rises or falls?
You know, I think getting to convention is harder than ratification. There are those who would disagree with me just because of numbers, but this is the way I see it. From an on-the-ground practical political perspective, very hard to get either of them done. Super hard to get to convention. 34 is a high bar. It takes a massive amount of political organizing. We're literally organizing in every state legislative district in the nation. It's like a presidential campaign, only longer and more permanent and with more depth. It's just required, because you have to work state legislative district by district. So getting to convention, I think, is the hardest part. Why I think it's easier to ratify is, the closer you get to convention, the more politicians behave how they behave, and they want to jump in front of the parade. When they see the parade is moving, and I estimate that will happen somewhere between 20 and 25 states, when that happens, they'll start jumping in front of it and saying, look, I've always been in favor of this. I'm the convention guy. And when you get amendments that actually come out of convention, that means that 34 states have agreed on it, the majority of people likely in 34 states agree, then even more politicians are going to jump on the bandwagon. I don't think it's hard to get to 38 on whatever you can get out of a convention.
And what about the states that have ratified or are close to doing this to get the convention? Are there any states run by Democratic governors and Democratic legislatures, or are they going to be the last ones who will agree to this?
Well, right now, first of all, important to note that governors are not necessary to the process, because it's not legislation, it's a resolution, it's just a joint resolution.
But are they taking a position generally?
Generally speaking, they're not taking any position, and the Democratic legislatures are generally against this. And it's on the basis where you and I started this whole conversation. When you get guys like Mark Meckler and Jim DeMint and Tom Coburn, who are sort of the figureheads of this thing, there's a natural, and honestly, I hate to say this, but I don't think inappropriate reaction that they look at it and say this is some sort of crazy conservative thing. I mean, I would certainly, that would be my first reaction if I saw a bunch of leading figures on the left leading something. It would be hard for me to buy in immediately. But I think that one of the fulcrum points that's taking place in America right now, much to my surprise, is President Trump. And that there are now so many people on the left that are so afraid of Washington, D.C. And I'm going to say it straight up, they should be. They should be under an Obama administration, and they should be under a Trump administration. And I feel the same way about both. And that's no disrespect to either administration. I just don't want a presidential administration having very much effect on my life. The founders never intended it to be that way. It was intended so little to be that way that at the time of the founders, it was considered inappropriate for presidential candidates to campaign, literally, because it wasn't supposed to be that important to individual people who the president was. And so that's what we're trying to get back
to. Boy,
has
that changed, huh?
It's changed radically. And what we're trying to do, Larry, and this is, again, really important. Remember, an important thing to remember is I grew up in California, all right? I would describe myself as a country boy. I'm kind of a redneck. I live in rural Northern California, but I grew up in Los Angeles, California, a very liberal place. So I have a full understanding and a full appreciation for the spectrum of political thought in this country, and I have friends all across the spectrum. And we still love each other. We're frustrated with each other in politics, but we still love each other. Here's what I think is going on in this country that we need to fix. Mm-hmm. We hate each other over politics. It's crazy. It's stupid, and it wasn't meant to be this way. But the reason we hate each other over politics is because D.C. is deciding for all of us. And when you do that, you're going to make 50% of us mad, no matter what. And so if we take that power away from D.C., which is that's what this is all about, who decides, and we give it back to the states, then we can debate these things at home in the states in a much more friendly, neighborly way. That's the way these issues were meant to be resolved.
But Mark Meckler, are you worried that we do have a number of amendments already to the Constitution? It is, by its nature, somewhat a limiting document as to the government's ability to restrain our speech and our protests and so on and so forth, that the same concerns that you had before this convention, and if it were successful in terms of getting the ratification, would exist, that there would be still a very strong judiciary that would begin to roll back some of the things that you've amended?
You know, I think the answer to that is yes, 100 years from now. And so I'm not worried about what happens 100 years from now. If you look at the history of amendments in this country, I'm not just making this up, they're very closely followed for the first 100 years, roughly, before we really start to drift from them. And the reason for that isn't any magic in the amendments. It's just straight up political reality. In other words, the courts respond to political reality as much as any other branch of government. And when you have a nationwide tide sweeping that says we want to take the power back and give it back to the states, ultimately the courts will go along with that. Also, remember, one of my favorite amendments is limiting the terms of the judiciary. That would help a lot as well. Because these guys serve for life, they're part of the federal government. They see themselves that way over the long term. Their pensions are vested with the federal government. There's a lot of reasons for them to expand federal power. That would change dramatically if we term limited the federal judiciary.
Are you having any impact on what I've been reading about, for example, in New York State, where there's a split on a constitutional convention in the state, and some very unusual alliances are forming ahead of this vote that they have in the fall over holding a referendum, and this occurs every 20 years. But do you see this lighting a fire in various legislatures who are looking at where power is in the local towns and cities versus states?
You know, it's interesting because I'm following that, and I expected to feel and see some crossover, but I'm really not seeing it. Those issues seem to be isolating themselves to the state legislatures. They don't really seem to be affecting our movement more broadly.
Okay, in closing, what I'd like to do is let people know who are interested in becoming volunteers, and I know you're looking for state videographers. You've got a whole raft of things that people can do if they're interested in this. What is it that you would encourage people to do, and how can they do it, and where should they go to find out more about the Convention of States?
Sure, go to conventionofstates.com. First, read about it, learn about it, sign the petition. That'll go to your state legislator and let them know that you support a convention of states. And that's important whether your state's passed it or not. And then get involved. There are all kinds of ways you can be involved. Just be a low-level, basic volunteer who's willing to call your state legislator. But like you said, we need state videographers, what we call social media warriors, information analysts, whatever your skill set or your talent is, if you just like to be on the phone, whatever it is, I promise you we can put you to work. And you are needed. We're not going to save the country without you. So go to conventionofstates.com.
All right, great. Mark Meckler, a co-founder of this movement. And I thank you so much for being with us today on americatrendspodcast.com.
Thanks for having me, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Great job. Thank you.
If you like this episode, please leave us a kind rating or review. I'm on my hands and knees. Please do it on iTunes, because your review is really critical for us to continue providing this podcast. And John, I know that iTunes looks at this. They want to make certain that we have some ranking, some visibility, and that we're getting some traffic, and then they give you better positioning.
Absolutely. And this way, it'll put us in the forefront so you can find us much easier on your iPhone or Android, whatever you may be using.
And they may even send you out an alert. So please, if you can, don't miss a single episode of America Trends Podcast. And, John, they can subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.com.
And also subscribe on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
We send out a little blurb, and we can also take your emails there at newsletter@rifkinradio.com. That's another way to get us.
And we do not sell or share
no
our
spamming,
lists.
No spamming, nothing.
Well, I don't know. Does anybody want our lists? I don't know, but we don't do it.
Good question.
Even if they asked us.
Even
nobody's
if they
asked us. But.
Right.
And when you do subscribe, let us know on Facebook and Twitter. We're getting very active on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle on both platforms, and John, this is really easy, at Trends Podcast. That's it.
That's real easy.
You like that? Did you get that?
I got that.
Okay.
I'm going to have to check it out now. I'm going to have to tweet it.
We want to thank you, of course, personally for subscribing. And we also would like to get some of your ideas and questions for future episodes of America Trends Podcast. And that's important, too, because we're all over the map. Our interest editorially in the future, John, has no bounds. But we want to know what it is that you'd like to hear from us, if there was a segment that you'd like to see us follow up on, or if there's something in depth that you'd like us to deal with. Please let us know that, too.
We're looking at the future. There's so much we can look at.
Yeah, and the topics that we've dealt with, I mean, we have gotten such incredible guests over the recent period, but they're only going to come to us if they know we've got an engaged and interactive audience.
Absolutely.
So it's really important that you become part of this podcast in so many different ways that we're sharing with you today.
You're absolutely right. We need your support and your help and your reviews.
And your ideas.
And ideas.
Or questions on Facebook and Twitter. And by the way, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using the hashtag Trends Podcast. You can also add an email address if you have a public one that you'd like us to give out.
Yeah, good. And you know what? You know what? We didn't mention Amazon.
Oh, yes. We have an Amazon store.
Yes.
And so if you go up, you don't have to buy the things that might be highlighted at that particular time. You can buy any book, and there's some benefit that comes back
just
to us.
Just put what you're looking at in the little search engine block there, and it'll take you right to Amazon, and it'll help us out.
Absolutely. And it doesn't really cost you anything more because they have built that into their pricing structure. So we get a little taste and you get more programming like this and you get the item that you were looking for. So it works
Absolutely.
For all of us.
It's a win-win.
Absolutely. Win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
So for more information on America Trends and for the latest updates on upcoming episodes, be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can find us at Trends Podcast. And again, you can find John and I here in our studio performing as best we can for you.
That's right. Let us out.
What's that?
Let us out.
Let us out. No one is. Hey, listen, thank you so much for joining us today on America Trends. We'll see you next time.
We hope to hear from you soon.
Oh, by the way, we are posting all the time, and we're posting on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Good point.
So just be aware, if you're looking for new episodes, they're coming on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you wake up, before you go out on your jog or your walk and you want to take us with you, we'll be there for you.
Very good.
All right. Have a great day.